Welcome to the podcast for the Journal of the American Academy of Physician Assistants.
Hello, everyone. Welcome back to this month's podcast. We hope you enjoyed our first episode last month and are back for more.
Yes, and we're excited for this month's episode as we review CME articles on tuberous sclerosis complex in early pregnancy. Well, Brandon will review the Art of Medicine article titled, Who is a Patient? And I will be going over a special article addressing the wage gap in the PA profession.
And the disclaimer for this podcast is a summary of selected articles from this month's edition. We share our take and opinions, and they don't represent JAPA, the author's or the editor's opinion, or the publisher. This is not intended for medical advice.
And remember, everyone, when you read both CME articles, review the post-test, and then take the online test at cme.aapa.org, and if you get at least a 70%, you get a one-category CME. Now, let's go on to the CME. Our first CME article, Tuberous Sclerosis Complex, a Multisystem Disorder, was written by Kellyanne Notaro and Bradley Pierce. At the time this article was written, Kellyanne was a student in the PA program at Marietta, Ohio College, and now practices in orthopedics at NAMS Southwest Orthopedics in Parma, Ohio. Bradley Pierce is an associate professor in the PA program at Marietta College and practices at Strecker Cancer Center at Memorial Health System in Marietta. The authors have disclosed no potential conflicts of interest, financial or otherwise. So, tuberous sclerosis complex, also known as TSC for short, is a genetic neurocutaneous disorder that affects the central nervous system, kidneys, skin, heart, eyes, lungs, and several other organ systems. It is characterized by the appearance of benign, non-invasive lesions called hamartomas in multiple organs. TSC is mostly a genetic disorder of autosomal dominant. However, two-thirds of patients have multiple sporadic mutations that cause the disorder as well. For genetically acquired TSC, this involves mutations on two specific tumor suppressor genes, TSC19P34 and TSC216P13. The TSC1 gene encodes for harmatin, and the TSC2 gene encodes for tuberin protein. Simply put, both of these proteins are responsible for inhibiting cell signaling pathway that controls cell growth and proliferation. The specific pathway is called the mammalian target of rapamycin, also known as mTOR, but we'll circle back to this later. For the epidemiology, TSC affects about 1 in 6,000 newborns in the U.S., and about 40 to 80,000 total within the U.S. have TSC. However, this number may actually be higher, as this is easily misdiagnosed. Since TSC affects multiple organ systems, we're going to break things down organ system by organ system, so brace yourself. Neurological manifestations. Seizures are the most frequent sign of TSC, as 85% of patients with TSC experience epilepsy disorder. In infants, they may experience infantile seizures, which I wasn't too familiar with what these look like. Basically, they involve a sudden stiffening of the body with a brief bending or flexion of the arms, legs, or head that only lasts a few seconds. They can be easily missed. Additionally, focal seizures are common, as patients with TSC that experience seizures are also most likely to have neurocognitive deficits such as autism spectrum disorder, intellectual disability, and mood disturbances. The overall term to describe this phenomenon of impairments is called TAND, which stands for TSC-associated neuropsychiatric disorders. Additionally, central nervous system tumors are common as well, and there are three main types. The first type is cortical tubers, defined as disorganized collection of abnormal yet benign cells in the cortex. Because they are located in the cortex, they likely contribute to the seizures. Also, there are subependymal nodules, which are calcium-containing nodules that are located below the ependyma of the lateral ventricles. And lastly, there are giant cell astrocytes, also known as CEGA. These tumors can lead to serious complications such as obstructive hydrocephalus. For dermatological manifestations, adenoma sebaceum are angiofibromas that develop during childhood. These are red, or if your patient is more melanated, they may be hyperpigmented papules on the face, mostly along the nose and cheeks, in a butterfly-like pattern around the nasal folds and malar eminences. 75% of patients with TSC will usually have angiofibromas, and they will usually begin to appear after the age of 5. Additionally, patients with TSC will have Sjögren patches, which are irregularly shaped and thickened plaques usually found on the lower back. They will usually either be skin-colored or, again, in patients of color, they may be hyperpigmented. Hypomelanotic macules are hypopigmented or white patches on the skin that appear at birth or in early infancy. They are predominantly located on the trunk, arms, and legs, but vary in size and shape. However, 90% of patients with TSC have these lesions, so it's important not to miss these, especially since their appearance can easily be confused with other skin findings such as vitiligo or maybe even tinea versicolor. For cardiac manifestations, the main one is rhabdomyomas. These are benign tumors of the heart that occur in 50% of patients with TSC. They are mostly found in the ventricles and usually are asymptomatic, but they can cause arrhythmias, with the most commonly being Wolff-Parkinson-White or WPW syndrome. Just a quick review on WPW. This is an accessory pathway at the bundle of Kent, which pre-excites the ventricles. On EKG, you're going to notice a slurred wide QRS known as a delta wave. And with patients with WPW syndrome, you just want to manage them with either vagal maneuvers, procainamide, and avoid what we know as the ABCD drugs, adenosine, beta blockers, calcium channel blockers, and digoxin, since these are AV nodal blockers. For renal manifestations, angiomyolipomas, also known as AML, are benign renal neoplasms composed of fat, smooth muscle, and vascular tissue. They are found in 80% of patients with TSC. Though they are benign, they can bleed, leading to chronic kidney disease. Additionally, renal cysts are common in patients with TSC and are again associated with chronic kidney disease and hypertension. These are a little less common in TSC patients because they're only in 40% of the population. But it's important to not confuse these with polycystic kidney disease, as the two can coexist. Patients with renal cysts are usually asymptomatic, but again, if patients have the TSC2 or the PKD1 gene deletions, these cysts can become large and lead to end-stage renal disease in younger patients. Patients can also have retinal hamartomas, but these do not cause any visual disturbances and are usually found in younger patients. Additionally, achromic patches are areas of hypopigmentation on the retina in patients with TSC, but again, these do not cause any visual disturbances. For pulmonary manifestations, the most common one are lymphoangiomyomatosis, also known as LAM, which are benign appearing smooth muscle cells that infiltrate the lung structures. They're more common in women with TSC, and the symptoms can be progressive dyspnea on exertion, and overall, this manifestation is difficult to treat and carries a poor prognosis. For a diagnosis of TSC to be made, patients must present with either two major features or one major feature with two or more minor features. The article has a really nice chart that goes over major features versus minor features. But in brief, some major features are hypomelanotic macules, and patients must have three or more of these, angiofibromas, Sjögren patches, multiple retinal hamartomas, and cortical dysplasias. Minor features include confetti skin lesions, dental enamel pits, retinal achromic patch, and multiple renal cysts. Additionally, genetic testing can confirm mutations of either the TSC1 or TSC2 genes and can also confirm the diagnosis of TSC. And of course, in addition to these, diagnostic imaging can also be utilized as well, such as brain CT or MRI to diagnose CNS tumors, EEG to diagnose seizures, and ultrasound to diagnose renal cyst and polycystic kidney disease. For treatment and management of TSC, follow-up exams and monitoring are key. Again, the article has a really nice chart that breaks down how frequently providers should monitor each specific manifestation in patients with TSC. Pharmacological management involves the use of mTOR inhibitors, and these are usually used to manage subependymal giant cell astrocytomas, angiofibromas, rhabdomyomas, and LAM. For patients with seizure disorders, anticonvulsants can be used, and for infantile seizures, corticotropin gel injections can also be utilized. The rest of management is supportive, utilizing an interdisciplinary team of neurologists, cardiologists, dermatologists, and several other specialties to help manage patients with TSC.
Thank you, Lena. That was a great article and great review of everything, especially with all the many clinical manifestations. I've never heard of TSC before, so coming across that and being sure to keep your differential open when coming across all these different presentations definitely be helpful. Our next CME is by Ms. Toni Jackson and Ms. Elise Watkins. The authors have disclosed no potential conflicts or interests, financial or otherwise. The article is titled EPL, aka Early Pregnancy Laws, are also known as spontaneous abortion. This is important because many patients present with vaginal bleeding in the first trimester of pregnancy, so therefore clinicians must know appropriate evaluation, diagnosis, and optimal treatment for this potentially life-threatening event. So to start things off, just as a refresher, Lena, do you remember what the different types of abortion are?
Threatened, incomplete, incomplete abortion.
Yeah, so the first kind is threatened, and that is when a patient will have bleeding, cramping, but however, the cervical os will be closed and the fetus will still be intact. The other kind, as you said, is incomplete, which is when the patient has a non-viable intrauterine pregnancy that is found on ultrasound with products of conception still in the uterus. And these patients typically have symptoms of, again, the vaginal bleeding and pelvic cramping, but they'll also have a dilated os. And for a complete abortion, that's when there are no products of conception in the uterus and the cervical os is closed and there's no symptoms of bleeding or cramping, anything of that. Lastly, there is an anembryotic pregnancy, which previously was known as a blighted ovum, and that is when a fertilized egg is implanted into the endometrium, however, fails to develop into an embryo. So we think about the causes of this, and when it comes across my mind, I think about infections, bacterial and viral. So you think of your STDs, chlamydia, gonorrhea, and also HSV, CMV, and HPV, to name a few. We also must take into account the immunologic aspect of it. I think it's fair enough to say that pregnancy is an amazing process on how a million and one things have to line up perfectly to have a viable pregnancy. So during pregnancy, a mother's immune system is temporarily arrested to prevent the destruction of this foreign body that is implanted in the uterus. However, there are times where the body recognizes an embryo just as another foreign body and goes along with its process. We must also look at underlying maternal risk factors. Number one, we think of Asherman syndrome, which are intrauterine adhesions, also uterine fibroids and endometrial polyps. Also, any anatomic abnormalities like a bicorniate or unicorniate uterus can lead to EPL. With the theory behind that, the abnormal anatomy is associated with a lack of blood flow, making the endometrium unfavorable for implantation. And also, we can think about endocrine disorders such as diabetes, polycystic ovarian syndrome, and thyroid disease. And there wasn't really any hard evidence as to why these would lead to EPL, according to the article. But as stated earlier, so many things have to line up perfectly. We must also consider age, where there's a slight increased chance of EPL when women are under the age of 20, and then it decreases in the mid to late 20s, and then there's a steep increase at the age of 30, and then by the age of 45, the chance of EPL is all the way at 53%. We think about maternal stresses, and we also think about external factors such as drug and alcohol use, and certain antibiotics such as macrolides, Flagyl, as well as tetracyclines and fluoroquinolones. Elena, what would have to be your guess for the most common cause of EPL if you had to take just a wild guess at it? And just a hint, I didn't mention it yet.
Genetic abnormalities?
Man, you're on the ball today. Fetal karyotype abnormalities are by far the leading cause of EPL, and we think of the single autosomal trisomy like 16, 21, and 22. And now, what does the clinical workup look like for this? Each patient should undergo a speculum exam, which will give the clinician better insight on cervical dilation or if the cervix is closed, and which, as we know, could be representative of a missed abortion as well. There also should be a bimanual exam completed, which will also help to rule out things such as an ectopic pregnancy or molar pregnancy, your blood work with your CBC and HCG, and confirmation of the Rogram status. And lastly, ultrasound is vital to confirm the diagnosis as it gives a direct visualization of the gestational sac. And lastly, for the management of EPL, it's all contingent on the patient's presentation. For example, if the patient is hemodynamically stable, afebrile, and less than 13 weeks and 6 days of being pregnant, you can inform the patient to allow the body to naturally expel the non-viable products. However, be sure to inform them of the signs of infection or excessive blood loss, where they should go to the ER as soon as possible. But the patient who presents with an incomplete abortion and is also afebrile and hemodynamically stable. The patient should receive 200 milligrams of misoprostol orally for one dose, 24 hours before a single dose of 800 micrograms of misoprostol intravaginally. And for a complete abortion, there is no surgical or medical management. Just be aware if the patient is Rogaine positive or negative. If a patient is more than 13 weeks pregnant, hemodynamically unstable, or septic, surgical intervention may be required. Lastly, clinicians should also be prepared to help support and address the mental effects that come with early pregnancy loss, as many patients begin to experience negative sentiments, which can ultimately lead to depression and anxiety. So being very compassionate and empathetic when dealing with these patients is also vital to their care.
Yeah. No, thank you, Brandon, for that review. I think the last portion was as important, that, you know, a lot of women begin to experience anxiety or depression after early pregnancy loss, especially if it's not their first. I'm just curious. I know you said that after age 30, there's a steep increase in early pregnancy loss. I wonder if, which is as it becomes more common when women freeze their eggs while they're in their 20s, if this kind of decreases that risk. That's just something I wonder. Mm-hmm. But moving on, our next article is The Wage Gap in the PA Profession: Historical Context, Contributing Factors, and Solutions, written by Susan Shillen Marvel. Susan practices with the Trauma and Acute Care Surgery Team at Overlake Hospital Medical Center in Bellevue, Washington. The author has disclosed no potential conflicts of interest, financial or otherwise. I just want to put another disclaimer in that's mentioned at the end of the article, but I think it's really important to mention at the beginning. This is a direct quote from the article. The author did not further explore the systemic discrimination faced by colleagues who identify with other oppressed groups such as Black, Indigenous, people of color, Asian Americans, Pacific Islanders, LGBTQA+, or disabled PAs, as women in these groups suffer from lower wages, discrimination, and a system that is also steeped in racism, homophobia, and ableism. So, moving on, technically speaking, the wage gap is defined as male workers making significantly more money per year than their female colleagues. This is also known as unequal pay for equal amount of work. According to the AAPA 2018 salary report, get ready, female PAs make an average of $11,000 less than their male counterparts and are less likely to receive bonuses. The statistics are 47% of female PAs and 52% of male PAs receive bonuses. Not only that, when female PAs do receive bonuses, they are also on average less than male PAs by about $3,000. Though these numbers are unfortunate, it's shameful to say that this is an improvement, as the overall U.S. wage gap has narrowed over the last 50 years. And specifically in the PA profession, the wage gap, but from the article, it may possibly be widening again. As PAs, females are paid between 86 to 93 cents for every $1 the average male PA makes, which overall appears to be less than the national average, depending on your race, leading to a cumulative $1 million difference between male and female PAs over a 40-year career span. And not until 2012 did female PAs get a base salary that was at least 90% of what male PAs make. Now, some research indicates that the wage gap is due to female PAs selecting, quote, less demanding and more flexible roles in family practice, while male PAs tend to choose, quote, high-intensity specialty practice jobs. Now, the article talks about some possible solutions for correcting this, such as arming students with knowledge by increasing curriculum related to discrimination, implicit bias, PA transparency, and salary negotiations. But even more importantly, the article mentions that more PAs must demand for equal pay from employers and colleagues, and having difficult conversations about pay transparency, discouraging discriminatory behavior, and examining one's own behaviors that can contribute to this. Also, it also mentions that we shouldn't depend on the goodwill of employers to offer competitive salary, and then carrying an individual responsibility to continue to push for higher wages in the PA profession. Brandon, what are your thoughts?
Thank you, Lita. Every time like this topic comes up, like it came up a couple times during our schooling. We had a couple lectures on like negotiating your contract and also like the wage gap between male and females. And I think that it needs to continue to remain a topic that is talked about in order to help decrease this gap, because there's no reason why, simply based on gender, people should be getting paid less than. So I think that is encouraging for like new grads to start obviously utilizing the salary report, but also communicating with your coworkers, being a little bit more transparent about what you make. I think you'll be able to help yourself in regards to leveraging what you make compared to others and moving forward if you in your next position.
Something that Adrian always told us, and it stuck in my mind, is that whatever you ask for in your first job, that kind of sets your base for the rest of your career. Sometimes it's a little bit harder to negotiate higher and higher, as the gap between, you know, your first job salary is going to be much lower than maybe what you might ask for in your second job. So I think it's important that women, we also arm ourselves when we go into interviews and know the statistics and what the average pay is for our job. And again, I think something we were discussing earlier was also asking a little bit more than what your goal is, so that way there's room to negotiate as well. I'm also, as a woman of color, just always curious about how this even breaks down even more so amongst different races. I know the article said that gender is the only factor or variable that accounts for the wage gap in the PA profession, but I also know there are so few PAs of color that I wonder if it's just that the data is just not there.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah, thank you for overviewing that article. That it's always well needed, very much needed, to have that in discussion. So our last article for the day is by Miss Cameron Young Sweeney, and the author again has disclosed no potential conflicts of interest, financial or otherwise. So the title of this last article was "Who is the Patient?" And I don't want to give too much away because it's a pretty short article. And it's a great read, so I don't want to give much away. I think it's a great story just to read on your own. But I think that this article gives us the opportunity to reflect on the severity of the COVID-19 pandemic, especially in this country. There's some people who directly or know of someone who has experienced a little bit of fever, loss of taste, and the general flu-like symptoms. However, on the other side of the spectrum, there are people who have been experiencing severe shortness of breath, oxygen saturations in the 80s, intubation, and ultimately death. With the rollout of the vaccines, we can at least hope that we are progressing to what we once knew as a normal lifestyle. However, as the article emphasizes, we must still be cautious and wear our mask. It's an unfortunate reality that many people will never believe that COVID-19 is real, despite the consequences that we as healthcare providers have seen over the past year. A concept one of my friends once told me that has stuck with me over the years was that your actions don't always affect you, but can affect so many others around you, intentionally or unintentionally. So if I can leave you with one thing, it is always to be kind to others, whether that is in the form of lending a helping hand or a smile, or simply wearing a mask in public settings.
Yeah, no, thank you, Brandon, for that. I think the theme of 2020 was just kind of revealing how, unfortunately, selfish we as a country have been to one another. And I think it's just, again, like how you mentioned, us as providers, we get to really see the effects of COVID-19, and we really have to, we don't have the option to be selfish, which is something I'm, you know, always willing to do, and proud that I am a PA, because I am grateful that I do have the chance to help others. But, you know, I think that we all just kind of need to take a second to pause and not think about ourselves and think about, you know, our elderly neighbors, or, you know, even the people in the store, those who may have a chronic condition that can make this illness more severe for them. I know sometimes we can get wrapped up on our own quote unquote freedom, but this might sound cliche, but if all of us aren't free, then none of us are free. Mm-hmm. especially again, as you know, some of us are halfway vaccinated and we're starting to kind of do drastic openings of things. I think we need to kind of make sure everyone is fully protected against this virus before we kind of push things aside already.
For sure, for sure. Well, everyone, I hope that you enjoyed this episode with Lena and myself. We look forward to the articles in April.
And please be sure that you're following JAPA on social media. Their Instagram handle is at JAAPAOnline. And under the March issue post, let us know your thoughts about the topics we went over today. We'd love to hear your input. Thank you guys again.
And see you soon.